out of Austin, Texas. Thank you, Dr. Breeding.
Thank you. Hey, is your show archived?
It is at kboo.fm/Wednesday Talk Radio, and I will send you the link to that after the
show. Excellent.
Okay. Thank you so much. And we got to get out of here because we got Linda Olson Austin up next. This is Paul Rowland with Wednesday Talk Radio.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of After the Smoke Clears on Wednesday, November 15th at 6 p.m. at Revolution Hall in Portland. After the Smoke Clears is the first in a series of educational public forums on the Eagle Creek Fire and learn how our community can support the recovery of the Columbia River Gorge. The series will feature a combination of multimedia presentations on what happened in the fire and examinations of key challenges moving forward, featuring insights from a collection of noted fire ecologists, forestry researchers, and leaders from local businesses, conservation, and recreation organizations. Again, that's After the Smoke Clears on Wednesday, November 15th at 6 p.m. at Revolution Hall, 1300 Southeast Stark Street in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certifications requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is available by calling the station at 503-231-8032. Meetings will be held at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue, Portland, Oregon, unless otherwise noted. The events committee meets the third Thursday of each month at 6 p.m. Please call 503-231-8032 to verify if a meeting is being held.
And good morning. You're tuned to KBOO Portland. Here's what we have coming up for you this morning for the remainder of the morning on KBOO. Coming right up, it's Political Perspectives. Today, Linda Olson Osterlin welcomes Nita C. Crawford from the Costs of War Project. It's a team of scholars working to calculate the economic and human costs of war in Iraq and Afghanistan. At 10 o'clock, Eric Cascadia, headlines, interviews, and commentary. At 10:15, it's Flashpoints with Dennis Bernstein. And at 11 o'clock, The Food Show talks to Bea Wilson, author of Consider the Fork and How We Eat. And remember that KBOO keeps you informed, and you can get involved if you go to kboo.fm and click on Donate. You can become a member there. Thanks for tuning in this morning.
Good morning, and thank you for tuning in to KBOO Portland and for tuning in to Political Perspectives. I'm your host today, Linda Olson Osterlund, and our topic today is the cost of war. I also want to let you know that this is going to be a call-in opportunity for you in the audience. I'll probably open the phone lines in about 20 minutes. The number, just to give it to you now, is 503-231-8187. That's the number to call if you want to get in on the conversation about the cost of war. Once again, it's 503-231-8187. Our guest that I'm bringing you today is Nita Crawford. She is a professor at Brown University. Her areas of specialization are international relations, theory, and security. She's also one of the co-directors of the Cost of War Project at Brown University's Watson Institute for International and Public Affairs. She has a PhD from MIT and a BA from Brown University originally, and she's also the author of a a few books and or papers. I'm not quite sure these are published, but I mean, I am sure they're published. I'm not sure what format, but the one that really struck me as very interesting was her 2013 one called Accountability for Killing: Moral Responsibility for Collateral Damage in America's Post 9/11 Wars. And if you are like me out there in the audience, you have wondered if the American public could actually realize what the cost of these wars were, and as they continue to cut services to all forms of service to the Americans here, so the cost of wars continue to rise. So I thought it would be really good to get it grounded in our minds, and I'm so glad that Nita Crawford can join me today from the Cost of War Project at Brown University. Welcome, Nita.
Thank you, Linda.
So glad to have you on. I want to let people know they can also hear you. You've been on Democracy Now! A couple of times. That's how you came to my attention. I had been typing in things like price of war and hadn't been getting the kinds of things I wanted from Google, so I was very glad to find your project. Why don't you give us just a tiny brief background of how this project began and your involvement in it?
Okay. First, just let me make one correction there.
Sure.
I'm a professor at Boston University, and the project, yes, is based at Brown.
Oh, okay,
it's a little confusing since I have also worked at Brown in the past.
Yeah, but, and I saw BU listed somewhere, and then Brown University also, and I just assumed they were the same, but it's Boston University.
No. The project started at Boston University at the Watson Institute in 2010 because we were concerned that after what was turning into a large and long war, set of wars, that there'd be, at the anniversary in 2011, some kind of understanding of what the 10 years had cost in terms of the budget, the federal budget, as well as human lives. And so we looked at various, with the original group of people, about two dozen scholars ranging across disciplines, looked at various kinds of costs and consequences for that 10 years of war. And then we've continued the project and expanded to about more than three dozen academics, including political scientists, economists, anthropologists, medical doctors, journalists, and so on, people looking at various impacts of these long wars.
Yes. And your website, which is, you can just Google Costs of War, but it's at the Watson Institute for International and Public Affairs at Brown University, is a really good resource for those wanting to look into it. You have individual papers that are written on breaking down the topics, and you break down the costs really in sort of three categories. One is the economic costs, the other is human costs, and then social and political costs. And of course, there's overlap between those, but I found it helpful and useful the way that you broke it down and the way that you talked about them on the, you know, you and your fellow members of this project on your website. So I do really recommend that people go there to get more information. I tried to get information about Oregon state budget and the Portland city budget, and I was able to get, you know, reams and reams of information, but very, very hard to decipher. So I have some basic facts about that we can go into later. I wanted to talk first about the human costs. You know, my mind first went to the economic costs, but as I was putting together today's show in my mind, I thought, no, we really should start with the human costs. Not that economic costs aren't human costs, but let's go particularly to human costs. Can you talk about what you guys have observed and what you covered in this area of your project?
Okay. I think there are a couple of things to try to get a handle on the scale of the human costs of these wars. Let's just start with the American part.
Okay.
About 2 million people have served in these wars, the global war on terror, in Afghanistan, Iraq, Syria, and several other places that some of us are just now discovering the U.S. has been engaged in counterterrorism, like the Philippines and Sudan and Mali and Yemen and so on. But let's just talk about the major wars. So about 2 million people have served in those major war zones and about and come home to become veterans, you know, served by the VA. And they're getting care for things like traumatic brain injury, loss of major limbs, you know, musculoskeletal disorders, respiratory disease and illness, and heart problems, because these wars have been very hard on the American soldiers and sailors who have been there, you know, for a couple of reasons. One is these are longer deployments. They're carrying heavier packs, those who are on foot. The environment there, you know, for everyone, including civilians, is dusty. There's more dust when you run a heavy vehicle over the ground. The rates of deployment mean that people come back and they don't necessarily recover fully and they're out again. These wars have been very hard on U.S. soldiers and those who've become veterans. And so that their families are often caring for them, but the VA does provide disability compensation and medical care for people as well. Then, you know, of course, those the burden of caring for veterans ripples out to the veterans' families.
And yes, I mean, multiple generations affected by each individual who goes and comes back injured from it. And I believe it was something like 970,000 from those wars have had disabilities.
Disabilities. Right, recognized by the VA, and they're getting compensation. More than 80,000 last year alone were given compensation, who were the veterans of the Global War on Terror. The Veterans Administration talks about it. But then you think about not just the Americans and their families, but you think about the people in the war zones, and there are lots of consequences there. And first of all, I think we need to distinguish between the direct death and injury caused by things like bombs or bullets or fire caused by a bomb, an incendiary device, or something else. Then there's indirect harm, which comes when something like infrastructure is destroyed. Let's say when the United States attacked Iraq in 2003, they destroyed electricity generation capacity, which then meant that people didn't have electricity, but they also didn't have clean drinking water. And it took a very long time, because those water treatment facilities were powered by electricity, for those water treatment facilities to come back on stream. So some people didn't have access to safe drinking water for many years, which leads to disease, and in some cases
accumulation of chemicals, cholera.
Yes. There's also toxic exposures and so on. I'm just talking about the things that happen when you don't have the things you had before.
Yeah.
Like access to safe drinking water, electricity for refrigeration of food.
Medication. Many people my age rely on medication every day to keep us from having heart attacks or, you know, other problems that we've developed over the years.
Mm-hmm.
Without medication, we die, you know, sooner than later.
Right, or we get sicker. Then what you notice is also in Iraq, many physicians fled, as did nurses and other medical people, if they could, and many were killed or targeted. And then the same in Afghanistan. If the roads aren't safe, you're not going to be able to get to the hospital when you're sick. You could be injured because of, let's say, an improvised explosive device, or just you could have a non-war-related injury. But if you can't get to the hospital because the roads aren't safe, or there is no longer a medical facility there because it's been
destroyed,
then you'll have health problems. And then in addition, there were high infant mortality rates already in Afghanistan in particular because of their many decades of war. And those infant mortality rates went up before they went down. And so on. So these are indirect consequences of the fighting that lead to death and mortality and morbidity.
They're similar to the kinds of indirect costs of, like, say, Maria in Puerto Rico, or they've studied that after a large disaster, people die from all sorts of causes that are not directly attributable to it, but are a result directly of it. Lack of medicine, lack of food, undue stress on the body, trying to go too long without food or too hard of work to get to water. those kinds of things that result in the whole system collapsing.
Yeah, that's absolutely right. So what they found is in places like Afghanistan and Iraq, we have a sort of a handle on the number of people who are directly killed by violence. And let's just take, for example, the civilians in Afghanistan. About 35,000 civilians have been killed directly by bombs or bullets or something like, you know, some kinetic way due directly to the fighting. And then about 8,000 of those we can say were caused by the U.S. use of force. Okay, so of that 35,000, about 8,000 are directly attributed to us. Most of the people there die because they're either caught in the crossfire, we don't know who exactly killed them, or the Taliban, Al-Qaeda, or ISIS has targeted them. But so that's a lot of direct death over the years. But what you see is there's a large multiplier effect for indirect death. So it depends on the conflict, and there are estimates that range, it's either, you know, 2 to 8 times as many people die indirectly.
For each person who dies directly.
Mm-hmm, yes. So that ratio of 2 to 8, you know, one direct death could cause 2 indirect deaths or 8 times that, it's unclear. But we know that there's a lot, in other words, of death. And we're not really able to count up all the injuries in Afghanistan. There are estimates of, I'm not sure what they are right now, but around 70,000 injuries directly attributable to the war. But we don't know for sure about that. And then, of course, they have the same problems in Afghanistan and Iraq as we do. When you come home from war, somebody's got to care for you. They may not then be working because they're caring for you.
Well, and many people may not get to come home to any home they ever had before with any kind of network of family or support or clan.
That's right. And yes, many people are refugees in these war zones. They've moved to Pakistan or Uzbekistan. They've left the country, or they're internally displaced in the case of Afghanistan. And the same in Iraq. Of course, we know about the many people who've tried to go by boat to Europe, but though in Iraq and Syria, there are also people who are internally displaced or displaced in the region.
Mm-hmm.
So that is a burden to the regional powers.
Yes. You know, one of the things that I wanted to ask you about, I know that your project Yemen was not in our focus at that time, neither was Syria, though it's come into more, and some of your figures and stuff do include Syria. But right now we know in Yemen that there are probably tens of thousands of people who are going to die indirectly as a result of our support of that war and our weaponry. And I'm wondering if your project is going to expand to try to cover that area.
Right. Well, I think that we have talked about Yemen, though not as much, as you say, because it's not...
It's not officially our war, but we're doing everything. But you know, well, we're also helping pull the trigger. So it's
yes. Well, the U.S. has been engaged in drone strikes in Yemen for a long time.
Yes,
and also other airstrikes, and that's against ISIS and Iraq. I'm sorry, Al Qaeda. And so the way that the U.S. is involved then in Yemen looks like this. It's those drone strikes and other airstrikes against militants, but sometimes civilians are injured. And sometimes you don't know who's injured and or killed. Secondly, the U.S. has been funding Saudi Arabia and supplying the use of aerial refueling.
Which they couldn't do what they're doing without. I mean, they could do bombing, but they couldn't do as much and as devastating in the same sequence.
Right. And then the U.S. has always, been a supplier of training and weapons to Saudi Arabia. And Saudi Arabia leads a coalition, and the U.S. is engaged in supporting that coalition.
Yes. So we call the Houthis, we call them insurgents, but the Houthis, I had looked at Yemen quite a few years ago, and the Houthi is one of the longest, I mean, it's historically been there for hundreds of years, if not thousands of years, in exactly the territory they're in. They had one of the largest armies of any of the clan groupings in Yemen, and they are next to Saudi Arabia, but they had nothing to do with ISIS or Iran or anything else. They had their own historical basis for being there and for fighting to stay there.
I think that this is a deeply rooted conflict.
Yeah.
And what we have to ask is, has the U.S. either direct use of force or indirect use of force through Saudi Arabia made it better, or it's the same, or it's worse? And I think that the evidence is leaning towards that the conflict has become more deeply rooted and politicized, with many more international actors engaged. And of course, then the consequence for civilians is that more people are without access to safe places to live, and they're at risk of being injured or killed by the forces at play. It looks like, from what scholars have done, I haven't done this research directly, but the existing scholarship shows that the interventions that the U.S. made with the drone strikes actually increased the number of militants there, from a few hundred several years ago to now a few thousand.
So it's like a magnet.
It's been counterproductive.
Yeah, it's like a magnet. Where we go to bomb, they come to fight, and maybe we go to bomb them where they're already fighting, but it's as if they're serving each other's interests in continuing warfare. You know, Nita, we're going to open the phone lines in just a few minutes, but I wanted to, we've just taken a taste and, a glance at the human costs of this war, but let's go directly into the economic costs. I'm going to go ahead and give that phone number. It'll take people a little while to get on the line. It's 503-231-8187. And as we talk with our callers, we'll also introduce more information, because there's so much information here that we need to have. So let's go to the economic impacts, which, of course, any economic impact is a human impact, but we're speaking about the impact directly on spending and revenue and that. Give us a quick overview for the United States of what the economic costs of these wars have been.
Okay, I'd like to break it down into three baskets, and we can talk about them in turn, because otherwise I think it's just a bunch of numbers.
Yeah, I agree.
In the billions and the trillions, which is already
incomprehensible to our little brains, yeah.
Yeah, well, it's hard to imagine something that, if stacked, would reach, hundreds of miles. But so think about one basket as being what's already been appropriated or soon appropriated directly for war and war-related activities. Okay, so that's right now about $4.6 trillion through next year. Okay, and we can talk about what that spending is for, but let's just think about the second basket,
okay,
which is what we're going to spend in the future. Okay, and then the third basket is those things that we know have to be paid for, but they're not on the federal books. And I actually don't count up the non-federal, so we're not really going to spend that much time on it. But you could also include in that opportunity costs. So, but let's spend a little more time thinking about the first and the second basket. What's already appropriated is in that first basket. And then there you see what you think would be the whole story, which is the Department of Defense spending on war, called Overseas Contingency Operations. But that's not it. That's not the whole thing. It also includes spending by the State Department, which has its own overseas contingency operations budget, funding by Congress. And they work closely with the Pentagon in these war zones, Afghanistan, Iraq, Syria, and in training and so on. So in training others, troops and trying to engage in counter-narcotics activities, which actually funds the adversaries and so on. So they have an important role. Then we include additions to the Pentagon base budget. Now, the base budget is that money that just keeps bullets coming to everybody in the military, ships ready to be deployed overseas, aircraft. It's the big pot of money. We just yesterday the House appropriated or passed something like $626 billion for the whole thing. Right.
Wow.
So part of that money, though, is war related, and so we include that in the estimate. Then you have to think about what we've already spent on veterans' medical and disability, and then additions to Homeland Security, which are directly related to counterterrorism, preventing terrorism, and then responding potentially to terrorist incidents, and so on. So when you add all that up through next year, what Congress is appropriating right now, it'll be $4.6 trillion.
$5.6 trillion.
No, that's the what we've already appropriated or spent. Now, then let's talk about the future spending.
Okay.
Right, that gets you another $1 trillion, because a lot of that future spending is for the obligations that we take on as a society to care for those veterans we talked about.
Mm-hmm.
So, why is that so much money? You have to say, why is it going to cost us $1 trillion at least over the next 40 years to pay for our veterans? Well, we know that the spending for Vietnam veterans hasn't peaked yet, right? Here we are,
mm-hmm.
many decades after the end of that war, and we don't know the height of the spending for Vietnam veterans. In fact, I guess there's still one person getting benefits for the Civil War, which I was astounded to learn. Right. So this spending can go on. It will, of course, diminish over time, but it will peak several decades from now. And this is a promise we made to these people. It's sort of like deferred compensation. We promised when people entered the military that we would take care of them if they were honorably discharged and qualified to be in the veterans' healthcare system, to take care of their disabilities and their injuries and their illnesses that were related to their service. And to do that, we need to budget for it.
Yes.
So that's going to be about $1 trillion. I don't know when that's going to peak, but it will peak at some point, several decades from now. So I think that what we have is a low ball estimate there.
And then there's,
okay, go ahead.
I was just going to say, and then there's this surprising other cost, which is the interest we owe on this, because we, I was reading your papers, got educated. We have redone how we pay for wars, and we're no longer making sure that we're having taxes meet the needs of our wars. We're borrowing instead, and have been for the last, 17 years?
16 years,
16
yeah.
years. So there's a debt that we're incurring ongoingly.
Mm-hmm. Right. So when the United States began the war in Afghanistan in October 2001, the U.S. was in budget surplus. By the next year, the U.S. begins to run a deficit. Okay, so we've been in deficit spending since then. So there has been an unusual way to fund this war. It's never been done like this before, which is you borrow, essentially. In previous wars, you didn't put the war on a credit card. You paid for it as you went. So there were taxes and the opportunity for people to buy war bonds. Okay, there were some freedom bonds early on, but those left the scene more than a decade ago. And what we've been doing is borrowing from other parts of the federal government, which have money like Social Security, and borrowing abroad, from China, Japan, and so on, to pay for this deficit spending situation.
Well, an ever expanding war. I mean, we're expanding where we're at war every continuously for the last 10 years, as far as I can see. You know, we have someone on the line. Let's go ahead and get them on the line. We have Cody calling in. And I, for you who are just tuning in, I am talking to Nita Crawford. She's with the Cost of War Project at Brown University. And so that caller, do we have it on the line?
Hello.
Hi, Cody, you're there.
Good morning.
Good morning. Thank you for calling in.
My question to the guest isn't war a big money industry in this country? And is it possible that the people behind these wars are justifying all of this as a result, justifying these wars because of the budget that they bring in the War Department and our ability to build these weapons and to sell them at a premium price? You brought up Saudi Arabia, for instance. Everyone's aware of the turmoil that's going on with the Saudi royal family, how Qatar is being blockaded, I think, even by our own military. And I think it's possible that these guys are paying top dollar for everything for it. You know, and the connection that Saudi Arabia has to Lebanon and the money that could be made from starting these wars. I mean, isn't it worth going to war? And isn't it customarily, isn't the United States economy based off of war? And I'll take your answer off the air.
Thank you, Cody. Anita?
Yes. Cody, that's an interesting and important question. And I think there really is some truth to the fact that there are some winners. Most of us don't benefit directly from war spending. In fact, unemployment would be lower if we spent the money another way, but we can get into that. But who does benefit are contractors who provide services and large corporations. For instance, Lockheed Martin, which is an extremely huge company that sells equipment and armaments. Okay, so yes, they benefit. They make a profit. And in capitalism, they're supposed to, right? In a way, it doesn't really matter what they're making a profit on if you're a capitalist. You could be polluting. If you're still making a profit, it's okay. I don't think that that's a motive for the war. I think these companies benefit, and they're saying that they have technologies and systems that can help the U.S. fight the war, but we've essentially agreed to the war. Remember, after 9/11, we were all scared, and we said, essentially, here's a blank check. Do what it takes to protect us. Not asking whether or not the thing we were doing abroad, the U.S. was doing abroad, was actually going to make us more secure. We just said, whatever it takes. And Congress has been giving them, that is the Pentagon, and Homeland Security, essentially, whatever they ask for. And in this year's budget and in several previous years' budgets, they give them more than what they ask for because we've essentially said it's okay. So I don't want to say that it's war for profit, though there is profit to be made.
Profiteering, you know, like we've seen the screw in, the nuts and bolts in the Pentagon that cost, $150 per nut and cost 1 cent mm-hmm. to make, so we know there's profiteering in there.
Yeah.
And we know that part of this expansion of war, we hear them use the phrase, you don't hear it used as much as it seemed like it was starting to be used during the election, but the phrase, we have energy security. So we have energy security interests abroad that I think our drone warfare is part of expanding our ability to try to control other parts of the world. And so what do you think about that? I mean, I think there's definitely profiteering, and I don't know if, I guess I would say domination of the world militarily might be the purpose of these wars, if you were going to.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think that the purpose is security, and security, unfortunately, has been defined very broadly, meaning security of access to resources, which we should just pay for.
Right, instead of take.
Yes, and pay what people are asking. I don't think that Americans have a God-given right to whatever we want at whatever price we want it. But the issue of energy security is really a whole nother sort of line of inquiry. But I think the key thing from my perspective is we shouldn't be burning these fossil fuels in the first place. The planet can't afford it.
Yeah, you do have a paper on the environmental impacts of war as well.
Yes, but I think that we're not more secure if if we're thinking that by assuring access to fossil fuels is going to make us more secure, because the many more people, and the Pentagon well knows this, will be harmed, will die because of climate change, then will die because a terrorist comes to the neighborhood near you.
Yes.
It's just, we're talking catastrophe here in a way that the terrorists could not, unless they acquired many nuclear weapons, do. So I don't think that we're getting energy security. We're getting energy at a cheaper price in the short term, but the long-term consequences are quite high.
Yes. We do have another caller on the line. It's John. And before you speak, John, I want to let people know that number again. It's 503-231-8187. We're talking with Nita Crawford of the Costs of War Project. John, you're on the air.
I know a lot of people don't have time to read books, but years ago I read these two books. One was called Wealth and Democracy by Chris Hedges. And another one was, this guy's last name is Diamond, it's called Collapse. And both had to do with societies collapsing. And on this one little chapter, wasn't little, but on Wealth and Democracy, he was talking about how these empires in the past evaporated, specifically like Spain, which was, you know, on top of the heap in the mid-1500s. And what they did was they got little pity wars, and they gave a huge amount of money to the mercantile class and the Holy Mother Church. And so that was one of their, besides not keeping up with technology, but they just, spent out all their wealth really quick. On Collapse, he took five societies in the past, you know, and how each one of them had everything in common of going down, like depleting their resources again, and they're kind of, what do you call it, egocentric arrogance of themselves and towards other people. So even though we're in a high-tech, you know, 21st century technology, the human brain and nature still functions the way it did, you know, thousands of years ago or hundreds of years ago. So I think about these books each time I'm, you know, watching, you know, the news and stuff. It seems like it's one of those puzzles that you put together. It has 1,000 pieces, and you can see it coming together that it could be, you know, 2118 or 1518. It's the same game, the same behavior.
So, John, did you want to just have Nita comment on that?
Oh, yeah, that's all. I'm just saying what's going on now is not new. If you really go back in history, it's the same old show. That's all.
All right. Thank you, John.
Okay. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. That phone number again to get your call in is 503-231-8187. Be sure and go ahead and call soon. We don't want to have pile up at the last of the hour. Nita, did you have anything you wanted to say about that?
I think that's a very astute comment. And if John is still listening, I would recommend the book by Paul Kennedy, Rise and Fall of the Great Powers, which came out in the 1980s, which essentially tells the same story for many of those empires that he talked about. Because I think he's right that great powers fall when they spend their blood and treasure on military ventures overseas, and when they overreach, and when they provoke resentment and resistance, and they cause adversaries to balance against them. So he's right, but there are more empires than the ones he mentioned. Imperial Rome, the Habsburg Empire of France, Great Britain, and most recently the Soviet Union. So they all tried to extend their influence, and they all thought that they were bringing themselves security. They couldn't live with any threats to their vision of themselves. And in their quest for perfect security, perfect control, they did spend their resources. They bled them essentially dry. That overreach led to greater debt or higher taxes, and, you know, eventually their populations resisted or began to see their governments as illegitimate because they were taxing them too much, and they didn't want to do this anymore. They said enough. And this is because when you try to become secure by controlling everything everywhere, all the time, that's an impossible task. And that resentment that it breeds then causes resistance, and then the resistance itself becomes another reason why you have to control everything everywhere all the time. It becomes a spiral, a downward spiral, even as you're spending more in lives and money.
Yeah, you know, Nita, it seems that, you know, we have some forces like that that could push us to the end in this current era of empires. I wanted to point out one thing, though, that I find it interesting that China is not non-imperial, but they don't go about it generally with weaponry and wars. You know, throughout Africa, they're known for building huge infrastructure projects like railways, and they're working on another large road project to connect many places. And so I'm not saying that there isn't what was called in China Han centrism, a sense that they are the best and they have the right, but they at least have the sense to go about it by providing infrastructures to the countries they're wanting to access resources from. And I think it's an interesting contrast, and it'll be interesting to see how that develops as we go on. You know, all the chatter in the news about the new leader of China really coming out like a star compared to Trump in these meetings. So certainly getting positive PR from that standpoint. So I just wanted to mention them as maybe a slightly different model of how to do imperial, you know, when your goals are beyond your own borders, so to speak. I did want to mention that you go into the human cost, but you also go into the social and political costs, and we're sort of like reaching into that, and the environmental costs. And when you talk about the damage to the environment, I also think that might be one of the things that pushes a war administration into trouble, because the use of, and you pointed it out earlier, the use of war weaponry destroys and pulverizes stuff, making, you know, toxic dust, and also making drought and the inability to grow crops or feed yourself or have clean water. But we seem to be reaching catastrophic points with our environment. Here in Oregon, we had really much hotter summer, and we had it filled with smoke that was so bad. At some point, we were the worst in the nation. Mm-hmm. And then we saw Northern California and Southern California go through something similar. And, you know, your figures have pointed out that these wars have cost each one of us individually something like over $23,000 of our tax dollars have been taken to be doing this warmongering. So it seems like the kind of combination of people losing services, I can't imagine how much worse it will be on the streets of Portland than it is right now. But our streets are filled with people living on the streets. It's increased hugely in the last few years, and everyone who comes to Portland can see it. And it's not that there aren't some efforts being made to house people, but I see it just as a symptom, an ever-increasing symptom of the collapse of this economy, no matter how many times they say it's great for a larger and ever-growing segment of the population. It's not. And when we take away their health care and we take away the home care for disabled children, I'm thinking this is where some of those pressures are going to come to bear.
Right. You said a lot there, and one of the things I wanted to pick up on was about the homeless problem you have in Portland, which is everywhere. And many of the people who are homeless are veterans.
Yes.
Unfortunately.
We have a special housing thing for them that got built here last year, but it only housed 56 veterans.
Mm-hmm. In some of the people who are homeless and have military service were not eligible for veterans benefits because they were dishonorably discharged. Now, you can be dishonorably discharged because you're a bad actor, or you can be dishonorably discharged because you were driven by stress to mental illness you might not otherwise have.
Or you're not able to cope with either the structure you're in or the situation you're in.
Right. And so then those people are veterans but not eligible for veterans care, and they're homeless. So some of the veterans are eligible for assistance through the VA. But I also wanted to pick up on what you said about jobs and the larger economy. it's clear that military spending does produce jobs. It produces about 6 or 7 jobs for every $1 million that you spend. Okay. But if you spent that same $1 million on something else like elementary and secondary teaching, that's, you could get 3 times that number of jobs. Or if you spent it on healthcare, you could get 2 times that number of jobs. So the fact that we're being taxed and that money is going to something relatively unproductive means that we have a society that is less rich in resources for healthcare, and also healthcare workers, and the same with elementary and secondary education. And just think about other things that we could be doing. So you get about 10 jobs for every $1 million you spend on infrastructure or clean energy, right?
So almost everything important that we would want to do is better for building jobs than war making.
I think almost anything is better.
Yeah.
But now, and why is that? Well, it's partly because of the thing you mentioned earlier about and what Cody brought up, which is the profits.
Mm-hmm.
You pay a lot more money for a widget that's only used in one particular kind of military helicopter than you would for, let's say, a civilian helicopter, and so on. These technologies are very expensive, and we have a very high-tech military. It's also because the wage structure. So a public school teacher is not making as much money as an executive at Lockheed Martin. There are fewer jobs for people in the military or in the military sector that are being produced either directly or indirectly because of these differences.
Yes.
So if the U.S. Were to invest in these other areas, we'd have a much stronger economy, and in places that needed infrastructure, they'd have the infrastructure that they need, which would have a multiplier effect.
Yes. Well, we've got another caller on the line. It's Michael. Michael, are you there?
Yes, I'm here.
Thank you, and thank you for being patient waiting, but Nita has such good and clear information to give us. I always want to hear her, so thank you for
absolutely.
Waiting.
Absolutely. I'm enjoying the program. To segue back to this thing about war profits, the Bush family alone was responsible for multiple wars. George H.W. Bush was chairman of a company called Halliburton. Carlyle. He was chairman of the board, or on the board of directors, of the Carlyle Group, which they are major arms manufacturing. Dick Cheney, under George W., he was chairman of the board for Halliburton, which is a major military contractor. Is it any coincidence that we've been in endless wars when you have people who are profiting from it? And I'm sure this is just the tip of the iceberg. The military-industrial complex has bought the soul of this country. They make a profit off of every bomb, obscene profit off of every bomb, every bullet, every item that the military procures. And so that's my thoughts on it. I'll hang up so I can listen.
Well, thank you, Michael. Yeah, so the connection between literally who rules our country through Congress or the executive branch and the profit-making. Do you want to comment on that, Nita?
I think you said it well. That's really not my focus, because I'm more interested in, what we as citizens can do, to question the causes of these wars, right? If we didn't get into the wars in the first place, we could, if we questioned whether or not they were working for us, I think we wouldn't necessarily have these sectors with so much power. They have enormous power. They lobby Congress. They move in and out of the Department of Defense and the Pentagon, sort of a revolving door of the military industrial complex actually having people who who come out of the Pentagon, work in these industries, and then they go back into the Pentagon, and so on. That is all true. I don't disagree with it, but I think that we almost as a country reflexively sort of stand and salute and put our hands on our hearts and sing the national anthem because we think this makes us more secure. I don't believe that we're more secure now in a larger sort of holistic sense than we were in 2000 or 2001.
No, you know,
and I think that's where I'm focused. I think that yes, people make profits. They make profits on all sorts of bad things that they do or good things that they do. And sometimes we don't like that. But until we're willing to say that capitalism isn't a good, just, virtuous, and right way to make money, then I think that's what we have. And until we're willing to say that, you know, there shouldn't be this revolving door of influence of and lobbying, then that's what we'll have.
But well, and we have to kind of stick with that, too, because we've had rules about that before that have now gotten pushed to the wayside. But I agree with you. You know, if we had strong rules about no conflict of interest and no revolving doors between lobbying and being in an administrative, with the federal government, I think those, yeah, so I see what you're saying about that. One thing I do like, and I want to bring this up now, about the way that you've broken it down on the website, which is The Costs of War, and it's at the Watson Institute for International and Public Affairs at Brown University. You can, you know, just put in Costs of War, it'll come up as one of the choices, is that you do point out, you know, sort of like if we put our interests here, you know, in each one of the articles, if, you know, the sort of something we could do differently. And I appreciated that in terms of a look at what other choices are there to war? What other choices are there to this war and people pushing for and wanting to, you know, go, you know, diplomats. I was recently hearing that we don't have a chief diplomat in Japan and many other countries. So the normal forms of conversation that would be taking place between one government and another are completely cut off in many of the nations that the Trump regime has not seen fit to supply with diplomats. But I think that you know, your write-ups give us interesting takes on how we could do things differently. I do think we have another caller on the line, and I want to get him on. It's Chris. Chris, thanks for calling.
Hey, how are you doing?
I'm good.
I had a comment regarding something a previous caller said, John. Mm-hmm. And he said basically the wars of today are just the same old, same old. Same thing we've seen historically. And that is, in my opinion, greatly true. I think there is one notable difference, and that is we have a volunteer army. And you guys are kind of skirting the issue of addressing capitalism and all that sort of thing. But if people didn't want to kill other people, they wouldn't sign up. They wouldn't invent machines to kill. They wouldn't invent firearms to kill. Killing is rampant in our society in terms of what we see in the police and in the news, but even in our entertainment. It's in the movies. The good guy has to kill the bad guy. He never changes the bad guy's mind and gets them to repent and do social work.
Guns, you know? Matt Dillon did in Gunsmoke.
I didn't see that one. So you could see,
he did. He was a put that gun down and let's talk it over.
Yeah, did it work?
Well, in Gunsmoke, it did a lot of the time.
Well, so we've got one example. Is that the exception that proves the rule? I don't know.
The mythological 50s and 60s. I'm sorry.
Yeah. So, I mean, I think it's just important to remember that, or to be aware that there's a huge portion of our populace that loves killing. They kill their food, they kill their enemies, they kill their bugs, they kill their weeds. Killing is just rampant in our society and in our culture. And I think it's very easy to make the excuse that there's a cause, the bad guy, the other, you know, we're talking about some wars under George Bush or George Bush Jr., Saddam Hussein. I've met people in right here in the Portland General Metro area who have said to me, I hate Saddam Hussein. back in the day.
Yeah.
I never met the guy.
Yeah, hard to generate some hate. Well, Chris, let me I'm gonna let Nita in here too, but I do wanna say this. It's my firmly held belief that people don't that killing people is a hot thing, you know, that the way that we're genetically formed, we respond quickly and with anger sometimes and vengeance, and it's a hot thing. But the cold thing called wars and large general war, I think that's a social construct that most of us don't want. And I think the, you know, out of the 2 million military personnel that we've sent into these wars, that 970,000 of them are disabled. I think people don't like war is the truth. And I think people don't like killing. People vomit when they see somebody's guts blown out. People shake and cry and huddle when they see people blown apart beside them. And the reality of killing is not something that I think most people are easily tolerate, even when they've been conditioned to be soldiers. I do think there are some people that relish that or love the adrenaline. I mean, I've heard, you know, soldiers come back and say that the adrenaline, you know, they went back for that adrenaline and protecting their buddy, the sort of heightened emotional feel there is when you're saving your buddy and you, that kind of thing. But I, in general, don't believe people do enjoy killing. Nita, do you want to say anything about that?
Well, I think, if you can let me jump in, sure. I think you're extrapolating the after-the-fact attitude of someone who's seen the horrors of war, like, and which has been written about in history, of the old general who has nothing more than abhors war at this point, but is so invested in it, what else can he do? With the person who says, I hate Saddam Hussein simply because somebody told us to, or they burned our flag, or whatever it is, and the idea is, I'm going to go over there and kill people. You don't get, you get people going over and wanting going to other countries, or going to other places and killing people, because they think it's going to solve the problem. When it doesn't, and the poor individual comes back, and my sympathy goes out to every injured person around the globe who's been a catastrophe of war, when they come back missing a limb, their life changed, their mental stability affected, or their outlook on life greatly affected in ways that I can't even envision, then yes, they have a change of heart. But they didn't go in the first place thinking, I'm willing to have my brains blown out because I think the other guy needs killing. They always go thinking they're going to come back and the other guy's going to die.
Okay, well, Chris, I think we've got a good idea of your position, and
I thank you
very much for that. And we do have another caller on. It's Christy. Christy, we only have a few minutes, but I wanted to let you get on. Are you there?
Thanks. Yep, I'm here. I was watching the clock, and so I figured I was almost done.
Yeah, and we'll let Nita respond to you.
Okay, and I don't know if you guys talked about this. I only came about halfway into your show, but I'm really kind of interested in this idea that we don't really seem to have a very good anti-war movement anymore. So when you're talking about, you know, sort of the, at some point, the citizens are just going to get tired of this, you know, rampant military spending and... it is kind of interesting. I don't know who, if you know who Lee Camp is. He's a comedian and a political kind of internet guy. And one time he had this really great segment just showing CNN, for example, just a montage of CNN promoting war. And it was just, you know, not anything you really think about, like people sitting there watching things being advertised to constantly, like,
propagandized, really, by advertising and programming.
And when this whole recent conversation about healthcare, you know, universal healthcare, and everybody in the United States, even if they're for universal healthcare, they've been sort of programmed into thinking like, oh, that's too expensive, we can't do that. But yet, when we talk about the cost of war, or every time something military happens, nobody seems to even register the amount of money we're actually spending on that. So, like, we can't afford healthcare, it's too expensive. Even if we're for it, it's still too expensive. But every time something, you know, the U.S. becomes engaged again, or, you know, in Syria, or, you know, even starts to be involved in Yemen, or even the North Korea conversation, somehow even the financial aspect doesn't even register with people, even people who I consider to be, like, more on the left, you know.
Yeah, let's let Nita respond.
Yeah, I would love to hear it.
Okay, thanks. I think actually Christy and Chris's comments are related in the sense that it's this kind of reflexive patriotism that inhibits some people from joining an anti-war movement. And our responsibility as citizens to protest or to question is given short shrift in an overly patriotic and fearful environment. But this gets back to that the issue of militarism that Chris was talking about. I think, Linda, you said it really well about the individual human reaction, but training is necessary to get people to kill. And that's what military spend a lot of their effort on. And there are societies today that are less violent than they were in the past. So think of Sweden. We don't think of Sweden as a highly militarized and aggressive society, but under Gustavus Adolphus in previous centuries, they were. We don't think of Japan today, most of us, as a very violent place, though in the first half of the 20th century, they were extremely aggressive.
Yeah, very imperialistic.
Their neighborhood. Right. So it's not human nature we're talking about. We have to think about there being a couple sides to human nature, the potentially aggressive, as you said, the hot side, the immediate reaction, but also most of our effort, you know, in our daily life is about nurturing and caring and providing for our family. And we use military force when we think that we're threatened. Right. But we also use it when we subscribe to certain militarist or militarized beliefs that force works, it's effective, that it's efficient, it's not going to cost us as much as it might, it's our only alternative, or that it's natural. And none of those beliefs are actually grounded in deep evidence. We have lots of evidence to show that war doesn't work many times. It's hardly ever efficient. It's usually not the only alternative.
I got to let you know, Nita, I just looked up and saw that we're at the end of our time.
Oh, okay.
So that's a very good point you were ending on, though. And I want to thank you very much. We've been speaking with Nita Crawford. She's with the Watson Institute of International and Public Affairs and their Cost of War project. You can Google that. You can also look at our schedule today. It had information about this on it. I want to thank you so much. Obviously, we could talk longer and more and in depth, and people should go to your page to have your information. You know, we can build our anti-war movement if we want to, and we're going to just have to do it. But I think information like your website is very useful for that. And this has been Linda Olson Osterlund for Political Perspectives, and I want to thank all of you listeners and all of you callers, and also Tammy Dean for